You're listening to Solarfest 2016 Radio.
Ordinary photographer. I like the antique equipment. This is not Vic. Oh, where's our laser pointer? This one?
Yeah, and that top button. The top. Yeah, go up one. Yeah.
This is not Vic. This is just another fellow who was on the Eclipse trip. And me trying to figure out why on earth anybody would bring so much equipment. And this is also an example of the very first equipment failure. We were desperately trying throughout the first and up until second contact why on earth he couldn't achieve balance. And this is the old, I don't know how many people have ever had the great Polaris mount or the super Polaris mount. Not really sure where that great or super term came from, but we can admit it was a mount and the Polaris was involved, but only lightly. So this is my first camera that I brought to the Eclipse. I was an antique collector of cameras, and I thought, well, this will be really cute. I'll just, you know, large format, wide field, this will be great. And it did not occur to me that the back of the camera, or the way that one winds the film, has a little red dot. Now, it wouldn't make that big of a difference. One, you look through the back of the camera here, and that displays what frame you're on. And then you take, can you get the big laser pointer?
Sure.
Then you roll, advance the film by turning this dial here while looking through the back, and then you see the number appear back here on what frame you are. Now, my first Eclipse, I'd seen hundreds and hundreds of pictures. I had already helped Vic put together presentations from the V8 Eclipse, seen the stories, seen the heard the go. So I knew what I was expecting. I knew what it was going to be like. I knew it was so exciting, but I didn't know anything. And got out here on the sand in Turkey, and my very first Eclipse, I have one picture. I have one picture because did not dawn on me that when it gets dark, you can't see the number through the back of the frame. So I just merrily cranked along. And now that also didn't include consideration for a completely gobsmacked I was when the eclipse came. Absolutely. How many have not seen totality? Okay. We're going to tell you this. You're not going to listen. You're not going to believe us. But you will not be ready. Nothing you can do will really make you ready. All your equipment is going to break. Nothing's going to work right. yours is going to work. I spent most of this eclipse on my knees sobbing.
Oh.
Not for sadness. It's more than so. Next eclipse, we're going to do better. This was Madagascar 2001. This was one of the larger aircraft in Madagascar. You notice it does actually say Air Madagascar. This guy actually had shoes, so that was a bonus. we were restricted to soft bags. We didn't quite realize why until we got further along, and that really had to do with how they could mash every piece of equipment all onto a tiny little pile that was in a compartment smaller than my 12-year-old. We had big plans. Curtis Horuska, Hollywood Eclipse Chaser, and he also once worked with Daystar before we bought the company. He had a 4-inch fluorite refractor that he'd taken and put in a titanium tube. It was really durable. We were going to get this. We were going to bring it along. It would be great. So he ships it to us. UPS. Hey, Curtis, where's the tube? I don't know. You should have it by now. We don't have it. Yes, you do. No, you don't. So we get the tracking number. And that tube came in the night before we got on the plane at 6 a.m. So we had to chase the package up to Higginsville. I think there was some drug dealer brick building back alley meet-up location with the UPS team that hadn't really opened a branch yet. So we got the piece of equipment, got out there. Here's our little itty-bitty airplane. Now, this lens, on the other hand, this one was special. This was just an ordinary old Nikon 600mm. And in Madagascar, as we said, the planes are small. You notice a lens that size. This is actually the lens that helped me understand how to bribe an official. when we got onto, actually I think it was on the way out, as we were leaving Madagascar, They started running towards us and trying to take the lens away from Vic, which, of course, this is, I don't have to say how expensive. And I'm getting up in arms, and the lens is going away, and the official says, only five, only five. What on earth can he mean, only five? What do you mean, only five, only five, only 5 kilos? 5 kilos, what's that? How many pounds? Anybody? 11 pounds? That lens is probably 26 pounds. We can't check this. And he leans in close to me and he says, paying small bills. So I quickly, I had one of these little money belts here, and I quickly rifled out a $20 bill and just kind of gently held it out in front of me. He pocketed it really fast. Oh, Vic, we're leaving. He made some tiny little noise, and we whisked away faster than you could blink. My then, how old was Erica? Erica was maybe 14 behind me. Erica, she leans in over my shoulder. She says, Mom, I saw what you did. I said, you're not going to say anything until we're out of the country. So my thinking since then, the language that we've decided to use since then, unfortunately it hasn't come up, would be, isn't there some kind of fee for the oversize? Isn't there some kind of fee? So with aircraft like this and bags like this, the two didn't mix very well. And on the very first flight from Antananarivo down to Nosy Mangabe, we were missing one person and 4 bags. The person came along pretty quickly, but the bags were quite delayed. And this is because they grossly underestimated how much gear we were going to bring in our carry-on. So they thought, all right, well, you have a bag, and the bag is this. But you can see that that's not an ordinary little Malagasy carry-on. So pretty soon they started actually literally weighing all of the guests with the carry-on on the scale before we were allowed to board the flight. But it gets worse. We get out to the eclipse viewing site, and you can see in this photo, the bag arrived. So the 4-inch floret made it. We were able to stack it up here, and the eclipse was now into the partial phases before the other piece of equipment came. So we had the mount that we had to make a changeover on during the partial phases. Most of the equipment worked. I couldn't say that there was a problem, but just physically getting all the equipment there, I couldn't specifically say that the program went as planned. But we got some nice stuff. APOD, that was nice. This was back in the bad old days of film, so this photo couldn't be processed or developed until the whole eclipse trip was over. And then it had to be submitted to the press the old-fashioned way. There was no Facebook. So the competition back then was a little different. This green flash we thought was super cool. We were still in the partial phases. So, and then eclipse composite work was in its infancy back then. We were all desperately trying to understand what Fred meant in his Espinac, in your description in Sky and Telescope. This was, I don't know, 2-3 pages of some kind of alien language we didn't really understand. So then we have Fred's first try, 2001. I'm going to let you go.
Okay, so I wanted to do something photographic, but digital cameras were in their infancy. So I'm like, well, I got to take some kind of a digital camera. So I got a Canon G1, which was one of the first little digital cameras. And I made it to an 80mm f5 refractor. And I wanted to do a movie of the partial phases of the moon moving across. And so I went ahead in Microsoft Excel and computed out all the times and figured out exactly when I needed to take a photo. So this is my little crib sheet. And during the eclipse, you can see I'm checking off, okay, I'm taking that one, I'm taking that one, I'm taking that one, I'm taking that one. It was excruciating because I was chained to this thing. Everybody else is milling around, having a grand old time, and I'm stuck here just going. So I decided next time we're going to do it differently. This was the result. I got, you know, a pretty good set of partial phases and diamond ring and totality images. And I thought, oh, remap it into this map of where the path had gone through the continent. And so I used Fred's map of what the eclipse magnitude was and This was kind of the genesis of Eclipse Orchestrator, which I'm going to talk about later, because I had to write some code to process this. And it just kind of evolved into an Eclipse photography program. But this was the first step on that path.
Okay, so now we figure out how to get the equipment actually there. So we decided to get a little more ambitious in 2002. We went to South Africa that year. The choices were South Africa or Australia, and the duration was under a minute, so we just thought that was just right out. So I, with my large format fever, some people say aperture fever, we brought a C925, and back here we have, I just seem to argue this point, especially before digital came out, that you can have aperture on the front, but you also get resolution on the back with a larger camera. So I had a Mamiya 645 and a Pentax 6x7 on the back. Again, this was Curtis's 4-inch fluorite. I'd seen Espinac with a fluorite before, so that must have been the right choice. So obviously, if Espinac has it, it's Espinac. But what happened to us this time, you can see we've got so much gear out here. This is a full observing setup. And of course, southern skies, so you're going to want to see something like that. I don't even know, maybe that's a tripod. It could have been another little short tube refractor. We just went to town. The trouble with that was that eclipse morning, when we woke up, it was spotlessly clear, but as you can see later, it was gone. And we were leading the group. We spent so much time looking at the equipment, working with the equipment, we did not notice that a cloud layer had come in. So this was the first year for digital. This was the D100 year. And I have to also report that the instruction manual for the D100 is not something you want to absorb on an aircraft. Okay, so we literally ordered the camera, it arrived just in time, and so that manual we were trying to sort out on the flight over to South Africa, and you have other things to do, that's not the time when you want to be reading your manual. So these tiny, puny little slivers were pretty much all we had, except when I was viewing through that C925, I could have sworn I saw red. You know this, wait a minute, was that my imagination? I know I'm supposed to see the little ruby prominences or something, but it was just there for a split second. I clicked the shutter, and I had to wait the whole eclipse trip to find out if I had seen anything. So here I have this little roll of 120 film, and I kept it in my pocket through the entire trip, just shoved in here, and nobody could... It wasn't going anywhere. I didn't take it out for security screening. I didn't take it for anything. And sure enough, I had a tiny little glimpse. It was not my imagination. So,
did a little bit of corona visible.
So some people call that a cloud out, but I have photographic evidence to the otherwise.
So now at this point, I decided I'm not going to be sitting at the camera. I'm going to program it to run automated. So this is 2002. I've written software in my spare time. I'll give a talk on the software later today, Eclipse Orchestrator. So what I've got going here is a little laptop, not in the field of view, which is driving this Canon camera. I think that was a D60 back then. And then I have a video camera going just for kind of a high power view. And it worked. It worked great. The eclipse was only about 30 seconds, 28 point something. And in that time, I got corona, I got Brahms, I got Bayley's bees, and did kind of early eclipse composite here, the different exposures, and it worked. It worked great. I was happy. You know, it took a lot of preparation, but we got there. And so next time, I'm thinking, okay, I'm gonna do this different. And
so this is actually the point at which Fred and I met. At this point, we talked to each other quite a bit, and I was particularly interested in this camera setup that he had. And when he and I met, it was right after Shadow was born. We went to Cape Town and had a few days there because the flight to get to Antarctica really was a challenge. We chartered an Ilyushin 76 cargo plane, and the Russians, they don't market, they don't advertise, they don't care. They're doing what is right. And so we sat in Cape Town for maybe a week. And in the meantime, this is going to be great. We have time to get around and know each other. But met Fred over here at the airport, finally saw him. He could tell me about what he had done for the eclipse.
Well, and I had decided, okay, it's Antarctica, it's going to be cold, right? So maybe can't trust the laptop to work. I should build my own thing. I'm an electrical engineer. I build circuit boards every day of the week. So I said, okay, I'll make a special circuit board that's rated to minus 40 degrees, you know, test it all out, make it in its own little box so I don't have to bring a laptop. And so I went ahead and I put together this actual thing. And it's a timer.
So I meet him in the Atlanta airport.
So I'm walking around the Atlanta airport.
And he comes up and he says, look what I built, Jen. Oh, cool, you built a bomb. It had not crossed his innocent little mind. Until I saw those words, I thought he was going to swallow his own chin. So we had quite a ride to get down to it. Nobody noticed. They didn't
Nobody
care.
Nobody cared.
Yeah, but they were too busy sticking fingers in cameras. So we've had more trouble with TSA touching film, touching cameras. For some reason, they really like taking them apart and sticking their fingers inside. That's their favorite. So so in Antarctica, there was just this rush, this flurry, this uncertainty. Are we going to get there? We had to have the skies clear enough, because when you fly that aircraft down to the ice runway, this is polished with a Zambudo, by the way. They put it down there, and they just polished up and landed the aircraft on it. But there's no fuel there. There's no support there. There's no tower there. They have to pretty much fly a circle around the runway and say, yep, it's good to land. Important tip, if you're going to have a group of people, do not make all the bags look alike. I would say that this probably added an hour and 45 minutes to our processing time, getting on and off of the airplane and getting things moved around. That was dumb. Okay, so let's just, if you know, you've got big teams and big people, matchy-matchy, no. Just let everybody be independent. And so once we got to the ice runway, we got off the aircraft with our little ladder. We were all hacking up and down, joy, joy. And then immediately, what was it, 5-10 minutes later, who wants to go out to the eclipse site? Well, I needed to go out to the eclipse site because my team on the ground was saying that this didn't look like the GPS coordinates that I picked. So this can't be right. I'm looking in my notes. I have the scribbling that I made right after I put new batteries in the GPS because it died on the site inspection. So as it turns out, if your GPS dies while you have a number up and you put new batteries in, it gives the new location, not the old location. My father, who used to work in the Army, said that this was a problem because guys in Afghanistan would get themselves blown up in airstrikes that they were calling in because the batteries died. Either way, we hop in this thing, I would describe it, what, as a passenger bulldozer?
Yeah.
So we had these giant big puffy coats on, and we all, I want in the passenger bulldozer. This is exciting.
This is going to be great.
So we have Vic Winter. We had David and Wendy Levy. We had Fred Brunges here. This is Bob Shambura. We had a couple of Japanese folks. And then we had our leader, and we all smashed in, and we got out to the eclipse site. And sure enough, it's not the right location. And this is a problem, because on this particular eclipse, totality occurred at local midnight at the South Pole. So it was coming over the southern horizon, South Pole, nighttime. Or sun was up. It was very, very strange. But there was a little hill that it was going to run into. We were in the point where we actually had to consider atmospheric refraction of the sun. We couldn't polar align because there was a magnetic declination down here is like 15 degrees off depending on what day it is. You couldn't polar align. The sun never went down. So we get here and it's abundantly clear the sun is going to go behind a hill. And now we're flustered. I'm Fred. What? Team members are running off. It's going to chaos. Everybody's
setting up their tripods in a bad spot.
And it's chaos. My sight is out of control. I don't know what to do. And Fred Brunges here. He says, well, let's go that way. And I can't get my laptop to fire up. Everything's frozen. Like, frozen. I can't. 20 minutes later, I still haven't gotten anything. I even tried to stand in that funny, what was that little, they took a little building, Quonset hut, and they slid it out on sleds, and that didn't help. And so he says, well, let's go back there. Well, prove it to me. And his answer was, over here there's shadows, but back there they're not. That's proof to me. Onward we march. So we marched back away from the hill because the apparent size of the hill would get smaller as you get further away. And it was working. It was good. The sun was getting a little higher, but, you know, trudging across. You'd think this is a little tufts of snow, but what do they call this type of ice?
Sastrugi, I think.
This was crystals off of some kind of movie set. It looked like styrofoam as you were walking across. It was really difficult. Now we're dragging our gear on a death march across Antarctica. Vic tried to have a heart attack. We'd left the pills behind. I couldn't raise anybody. So when we get to this point, we're completely exhausted. We're sideways. You don't know which way the sun is going. I think at that point it was in retrograde.
Yeah, and it was moving like that.
It was moving from west to east on the southern horizon like a bowling ball rolling along. So we said, oh, time's up. We have to set up. Here's me. I have the trusty C5. And I brought, my large format 645, and I had just a plain old ordinary Pentax with a fisheye lens. Now, as I'm viewing through my C5 here, it doesn't want to click. It just doesn't want to click. I push the button, and the shutter won't go. And so there's just something I tried over and over, and I'm getting more and more frustrated.
And this is in the midst of equipment failing all up and down the line. Everybody's having trouble. I was keeping batteries inside my jacket to keep them warm, and so you would swap a battery out, use it for 10 minutes, and then you would, you know, trade batteries and use the body heat to keep the batteries going. And so amongst all of this, you know, we're hearing these anguish all up and down the line. It's, oh, my camera died. Oh, my this and that. And of course, I was the ambitious one. I brought a Meade LXD55 electronic go-to mount to the South. That was dumb. So the LCDs don't work in the cold. So, you know, how are you going to do your two-star align when you can't read the controller? You're boned. So I had a giant boat anchor.
Well, there was also another problem you didn't consider, which is that we were over 70 degrees south. So your altitude adjustment only goes, what, 35? So that was out.
How cold was it, Jen?
It was like minus 20, maybe?
Yeah. The reason that the ice has these striations in it was because the wind would come down with nothing to break it, and it would carve it almost like water was carving rocks. They say that this part of Antarctica is a desert, and it's so dry they burn the snow for firewood. So I'm trying to make my Pentax work over here because I've just about given up on the Mamiya. I can't do anything with this. And about that time, Vic calls my name as I'm trying to dial something, and the back popped off. Oh. So now I've got Pentax film is almost, what, 3.5 by 5. It's enormous. Yeah. And now I've got it like hanging out the back of my camera, flying around, the wind is blowing. It's and let's not forget that in retrograde, this eclipse is moving at almost twice the speed. I'm sure Fred's going to correct us on this, but it seemed like it. So at this point now, we're all of the attention is into your hands trying to get your equipment to work, and meanwhile missing the spectacle of the sun moving backwards at midnight over the South Pole. Okay, we have guys there who were going to look for aurora. We had guys there who were going to look for shadow bands, and we're busy futzing with broken cameras. So I thought, wait, I think I have duct tape. So I went back to the bag, and sure enough, I found a little stretch of duct tape, and I duct taped the back. This is me duct taping the back of the Pentax shut. So that way, at least I could get a couple. Oh. This year's David and Windoodles Levy, they brought their Questar down to Antarctica.
So what I ended up doing is the mount was just immobile. So I had to make it into a push-to mount. And then this guy was kind of working. So it was doing the exposure sequences, but, you know, all the displays on everything is going out. I don't know if it's working or not. I'm just, you know, it's too cold to tell what you're getting. And so we're just like, you know, mashing buttons and doing anything, just kind of panicky. Get the shutter open at least for a little bit so we can get something, please.
We have video footage of Vic loading. Well, we wanted to take a selfie with him and his buddy Bob Shambora. And after we were finished, we couldn't find this selfie. We couldn't find it anywhere until we reviewed the video footage of Vic loading the camera. He went to load the camera. He opened the back of the camera. Somebody said something. He closed the back of the camera and then took the selfie with an empty camera. There's so much flurry and being flustered and overwhelmed, and the time you cannot pause. So this was my shot with the Pentax.
This is the bulldozer and the little hut they dragged out on the ice.
These are
all the other eclipse chasers. So we've backed way up from them to try to get that hill smaller. You can see the hill.
So this one, I actually got 5 pictures as the shadow rolled across here. So at first he was way off to the left side, and then he kind of rolled this way. And if anybody was to ask me what my favorite eclipse was, it was definitely this eclipse. You see this little mountain over here, that was what we were stuck behind earlier. So the sun has literally, it was rolled to the left like a bowling ball, and the moon moved, rolled over it equally. And because my C5 and my Mamiya just wouldn't click, that meant that with the top viewer, I was left with a C5 and an eyepiece, basically. And because I couldn't photograph, I had probably the best view of an eclipse that I've ever had, because I was then just looking. On a side note, after we came back from Antarctica to Cape Town, I'm really very frustrated. I want to kick this camera into the ocean. I'm trying to figure out, I take it out of its box.
Why won't it work?
Why won't this thing work? I roll it over, look it around, take off the
safety lock.
And I spent about an hour staring out a window, trying not to. You know that little lock, that the trigger lock that keeps it from going off in your luggage? That one.
What was your elevation?
It was maybe about 1,000 feet or so above sea level.
Yeah, the whole point of the recon was to go and find out how we could see a sun that had legally already set.
So we're in the little passenger bulldozer going back to camp, and I'm flicking through my images on the digital camera, and I go, there's a guy in my eclipse. I'm like upset. I'm like, the guy got in the way. Well, you know, I processed the image when we got home, and I thought it was pretty nice, so I put it up on the web, and it was an APOD, and everybody said they loved it.
Yeah. Wow.
What he was blissfully unaware of is in said passenger bulldozer. He's sitting in the little corner, there's a guy in my eclipse. Well, shucks. Sorry, all the stuff failed. And he starts passing this camera around. You saw how tightly we're packed in. And he passes it over to Shambura, who goes, slight little bit of jealousy coming out. He passes it over to Vic Winter, photographer, newspaper man. Every person it passed by, the jealousy, the green monster got bigger and bigger and bigger. But now we really appreciate this because it probably most accurately depicts what it's like to chase an eclipse, to be in the eclipse. And furthermore, it also shows you that the moment of the eclipse has less to do with the astronomical event as it does with your interaction and the environment with that astronomical event. So the next one was a hybrid. And hybrid required you had to go into an even tinier part of the path. I chose to take a ship out 4 days west of the Galapagos. Not in the Galapagos, let's just go 4 days west of the Galapagos. So we were 8 days?
8 days in
Okinawa. Espinac was on this one. We had a lot of folks on this one. It was kind of a
David meeting. Young was on this?
David Young was on this one. We got David Levy and David Eicher together for David Squared. That was fun. But we didn't realize until we left the Galapagos and we figured out that the stabilizers weren't working at all. So the ship, about every 7 seconds, would list about 15 degrees.
Eat your food as it goes by.
The most exercise you got was trying to stay in the bed.
You would awake to the sound of a TV crashing off a shelf.
It kind of bolted to the wall. It didn't do any good. You'd open the galley door to the kitchen, had a foot of water standing in it. You know, you literally ate your food with one hand on the rest of the food to hold it down. So viewing the eclipse was going to be sporting. And in trying to arrive to the ship, you know, again with the luggage, trying to, I thought, you know, this Altaz mount, the Dobsonian mount, would be great because I could be more flexible with this. So I brought the dog, and anybody who knows Singmaster knows these are not stock poles. We go from Miami down to Quito. So we get down to Ecuador and find that a bag is missing. It's no real big deal. It's just the one that has the poles for the Dob in it. Wow. So I had a pile of parts. But the ship was great. They said, well, you know, if we stop in one of these towns, little towns, Santa Cruz or Finn, one of these tiny little islands, they literally picked up some wood from the island and then brought it down into the machine shop on the boat. Because the engineer, he was so excited, he was going to help. This is going to be great. They locally just got into it.
Here, I think those were broomsticks.
No. That was mahogany. And so we told him about what size it was, and he went down to the machine shop and made 6 mahogany poles for the scope. And the day before, we had a dry run where everybody brought their equipment out. This was going to be great. I remember David Young was up here, and so practice moving my equipment, and it seemed pretty smooth. I was going to put the 645 here. You can see there's me ready to go, and in theory, it was all ready to go. It sounded great. And you brought what?
I brought the Canon with the 100-400 lens and the Eclipse Orchestrator running on the laptop because the bottle will not ever get used again.
And then, kiss of death. Kiss the water.
Oh, that's right. So, like the second day we're out on the boat, we do these little shore excursions, and one of them was on a beach, and I've got my camera over my neck, and I'm taking pictures and whatever, and I lean down into the water to check something. Brand new $4,500 Canon 1D camera. And this is the beginning of the trip. And so it was toast. It was saltwater damage. I had to send it into Canon. They had to replace all the circuit boards. It was like an $800 repair bill. Luckily, the insurance paid it. But that didn't get me a camera for the rest of the trip. You know, I had my old D60, which is, 6 megapixels? It was okay. It's like, I can work with this. So that's what I've got on the 100-400 instead of the nice brand new 8 frame per second, you know, Wonder camera that I was planning on. So I had to redo all these scripts and rejigger it all. I'm pretty dejected because, you know, every day, you know, you get up in the morning and you go, does the camera turn on now? Maybe? No. And so, you know, this is what I have for the Eclipse. I've done the one camera now, and I've got up at the top, you can see the All Sky Cam. I've got a video camera with a fisheye lens to see the whole sky. And I'm like, okay, you know, we're just going to make do with what we can. You can see the tripod legs are spread out because if they were just normally, it would have tipped over. So.
Yeah. We also had, a little, let's see if I photographed it. Yeah, weather. So this little dot down here, that was where we ended up observing here. And the big problem is when you're 4 days west of the Galapagos. I have to say, we got a team together, Espinac, myself, Vic, we had Clipsy, who was supposed to be able to read weather, the captain. We all decided, you know, how technically we were going to pull this off. And the captain looked at me and he says, what time do you want it to be? Nobody's ever asked me what time I want it to be.
Because as you go west, normally you would change time zones. But we're in a
ship. But if you don't go very far, then you just keep it in the same time zone. So his question was, how would you like to keep time? So what a sense of power and control. Control of time.
I deem it is 4 o'clock.
We thought, if we keep it on California time, then it's always seems earlier than it actually is, so we don't have to get up as early. So the difficulty there really was in communication and getting data out on the weather, because we woke up that morning and we were completely socked in. Now, this path, the eclipse path, was Espinac. I don't know if you remember how wide it was.
Yeah, tens or 20 miles.
10, 20 miles. It was tiny. It was teeny tiny little sliver. We did not have much to work with. And the boat went maybe 8 knots. So we wake up in the morning and it's completely socked in. We have no weather data. We don't know which way to go. There's no way to get anything. So Fred, who had pulled a Brunges here, I'm going to say Espenek and Brunges because of the Fred. So Brunges had been downloading satellite weather off of his satellite phone, hooked up to his little laptop. No, we don't still have that little lovely. And unfortunately, it was raining on us. So we had to sit out on a little lawn chair with the laptop and the satellite, and I'd hold a little towel over his head while the little arm stuck out to download.
To get the latest satellite. We'll
get it every 3 hours if you just give me, and it probably took 25 minutes to download each of these two images.
Yeah.
So then we got our weather data.
2,400 baud.
We raced inside, and now who's going to read the weather data? We decided that Clipsy, the storm chaser, he needed to read the weather data. And we could see that it was trucking along in a particular direction, and if we went in that direction, we'd have to outrun the storm, which didn't look likely. So the only option was to punch the core and drive directly into the storm with no stabilizers to head south. So, batten down the hatches, we're going to hit it hard, hold your equipment, and we drove into the rain. It was harrowing and terrifying, but we did ultimately pull out the other side just in time. And you can see how we did a dry run here. This is the captain. Oh, he was all into it. He was going to nail us right in the middle of the path.
Point of pride. He wanted to be on center line within meters of mid-eclipse.
And at the end, we said, oh, we were only 30 meters up, off center line.
It was within the ship. That
and the captain says, where were you measuring on the ship? So the goal, because the path is going this way, we noticed that the water was more stable going in this northwesterly direction. So we could go with the current and have the least wobble. So as you can see, we did a little dry run, so that was good. And then we came down again for the totality and went up a last time. But again, with this, we want to nail the center of the eclipse. Just as we are reaching totality, second contact, he backs off the accelerator.
He's trying to get it within, you know, the ship length, and he doesn't understand that you can be a mile off and it's just fine.
And so we're tracking along, all by hand because we have nothing we can track, except I think Pasikov had a gimbal.
He had a gyro.
Right. So we're tracking along and and all of a sudden the ship that's moving smoothly takes a big jolt like this just at second contact. So a lot of people lost out. So I had only one shot. The eclipse was 29 seconds of totality for 8 days on this ship. We got 29 seconds. But you'll notice it was just red prominences everywhere. We had daily speeds that went on for, it seemed like, days. There was no time for composites. Actually, a group of, I want to say, four of us, Mike Reynolds, Clipsy, you, and Vic, got together and did a composite. Maybe it wasn't you. It was, anyhow.
We did one
tiny little composite. This is our Fred Brunges here with his group taken from below with Clipsy. And I don't know if you can see the actual frame here.
I had to zoom way out because the sun, you know, was moving in the frame like this. So I didn't want to risk being too tight and have nothing. I figured I'd rather go wide and be sure I've got the sun in the frame.
I think this was the one that I got Mercury-Venus in superior conjunction.
Yeah,
didn't realize
you
until I came home.
Well,
in this one, I think it was on the sun.
Yeah.
You want that?
Yep.
You want to take it?
Yep.
You got it? Okay.
This, Jen?
Yeah?
That's the first total eclipse and only total eclipse I've ever been to that I did not see it.
See, the eclipse, you didn't look?
Because you were looking at the camera.
I did not take my eye away from the camera during the 29 seconds while I was running the shutter.
There was no time.
Time to look up.
Well, if you looked up, then you would have lost
the
frame. It would have been gone.
Because the ship, like you said, the ship was going plus or minus 12 degrees.
We have some, Vic took a still frame. There was a pool on the ship. With water in the pool. Kids were in the pool. There was one time I took Shadow, was just an infant, like 6 months old. I had her by the suspenders of her little overhauls, hanging on into the, and we have a time sequence of the water sloshing in and sloshing out. We discovered we really can't show that. It's seasickening.
Yeah.
So 2006, oh, this one went everywhere. It went through Turkey. It went through the Mediterranean. People were on the ship. I found this country, Niger, that's north of Nigeria. And there were local Tuareg and Wahhabi people. So I was starting to look at, ooh, that's an interesting destination. It was the Libya option. Opt out of Libya option.
Yeah.
Here, this became all about the sand. Sand. And the cars were actually not 12 volt, they were 24 volt. So, of course, was that when we discovered my chewing gum wrapper was a fuse?
Yeah.
I always chewed the same kind of gum and we
did a foil wrapper, I cut it into a little butterfly shape to make it into a fuse.
Oh my God.
So, this was the Kestrel. This was when the Kestrel made its advance. What you don't see is that the rest of the photo, we had to crop it out, because after a week and a half in the desert, Fred had lost 13 pounds. And so the wind was basically blowing his clothes off of him. We had a little wind. But we were able to pick up supplies along the way from the locals. Everybody thought Fred needed to lighten up, so we put him in the proper turban. And we had a gal on the trip. Everywhere we would go, there was always local people selling us things. And so we're going across the Tenerife. It's going to be very dangerous. We have to conserve water. And she says, will there be anyone to sell us stuff? So everyone from the camp contributed leftover. This is a sleeping pillow. This is some Dramamine pills. We had like an old used crunchy granola bar, so Fred was going to sell us some of those. But the locals were really colorful, and this was when we really started to notice that every person that we met, they wanted to know why we were here, they wanted to know what was going on, and they were all happy to see us, all interested to see us. You can see, remember this guy, he made it with his actual posts. We had to break it up into three different people's luggage, so last minute we're throwing it together, blurry blobs. But meanwhile, Fred has his act really well together, and he gets to talk all about this.
Right, so now we've got the camera repaired. I've got a new video camera. I've got the old camera. I'm really ambitious at this point, because it's a 4-minute eclipse. Okay, so I'm going to do the corona, I'm going to do Baby's beads, prominences. Let's do a flash spectrum. Never done that before. Let's do some polarimetry. We'll have the weather being recorded. So I've got a little space shuttle of stuff going on here. And it's all running off that laptop. So I'm just sitting around enjoying the eclipse, looking through my binoculars. The biggest problem was the weather. Well, it wasn't the weather. It was a dust storm that blew in that night. And so we're racking our nerves, and there's nowhere you can go. These dust storms are hundreds of miles wide. So we're just sitting there as the eclipse is starting, waiting for the dust to fall out of the atmosphere, hoping that it falls out in time that we can see the eclipse.
So actually on this one, I thought it was interesting because Fred kept his camera inside this Ziploc bag the entire trip, all the way up until totality happened. You can also see how well organized we were. Everything had a purpose. He had it all neatly laid out. I think the shoe, this is really important. It was going to be like this was going to be a camera mount. You'd be amazed how good a shoe is for holding your camera.
The flash spectrum was taken with a water bottle mount.
Yeah, here's a water bottle mount. There he is. We start to also see superstitions going on if you've seen an eclipse and you have bad luck. This is the lucky towel. It's been called the eclipse. It's happy lucky towel. It's bizarre what people find. Shave the beard, don't shave the beard. It's all...
So this is the Bailey's bead sequence. I think it was about a 2-second cadence, and it's second and third contact. This is the flash spectrum. So you see the photosphere of the sun. Then we get down to just the chromosphere with the emission lines. And then here's the corona. You can actually see a little bit of the 5303 corona line. And this is my polarimetry. I had a polarizer and I rotated it to different positions during totality, so that you can see the effect of the coronal polarization.
We have this was a mid-totality. You can see Fred's equipment over here. I'm over here desperately trying with my scope. So the sand played a big part.
You see how dusty and dirty the atmosphere was.
It's almost like the crud that lays around on the horizon, only this was sand. But it's, I mean, to the eye, it looked pretty transparent, and it's dark here because we are in totality. So with my Pentax, I decided I was going to get a fastback. Because it was 4 minutes long, I could take lots of exposures. Unfortunately, that also meant that I opened the camera during totality and let sand in. So the sand all over. So I'm over here just, why do I even try? I've done this like 6-7 times, and every time something's going wrong, and here's the little smartass over here. Everything he does, he comes up with the, oh, I just let my camera do it. So.
There's a phrase in photography called chimping, okay? And so when you're looking at your camera, and you're excited, you're going,
Also, Karen Mendenhall back here, and there was a couple of other gals that were back on this side. This is the first time that had ever happened to us. We're sitting here watching the eclipse, and everybody's so over, you know, you're overwhelmed, you're pushing your buttons, you're doing your thing, you're shouting, oh my gosh, and I hear, hey, Fred, how much time do we have left?
I don't know, let me go check. About a minute.
Okay, thanks. There was actually a point in which we were like,
is it over yet?
Is it? So this, the duration of 4 minutes is a really long eclipse. So the next one, we decided, Mongolia's weather's good, we'll go to Southern Mongolia. So here, the personalities were really different. Getting there, getting the bag said,
I couldn't fit in the airplane seat. So I had to take my shoes off in order to wedge my legs out under there. And I'm sitting, you know, with my butt off the seat.
Then when they say you have to pump your own gas, this is the first time I actually had to operate the pump with a brake.
And we mean pump your own gas.
It was real easy for them to make sure nobody stole gas because they just kept the key and the crank inside in the little old lady's house. So you always have to photograph the local wildlife, whether it's Lionies or Mongolians. You're also going to find that these eclipse pictures are probably going to be your best eclipse pictures. Then right before the event, everybody's happy, everybody's excited. This is what you're going to remember because this is how you felt for the eclipse. So this is probably more, put a little more attention into this than you expected. Especially, you know, you get into it, clouds are looking good, just have a good old time. You notice my C5 is now on Fred's mount over here. This is my busted AT-111. That poor scope. If you want to know why I don't have a fine focus, blame Mongolia. Pentax, I've thrown the 645 out. I think I've sold it by now. So it's failed me too many times. When actually it probably wasn't the 645's fault, the poor equipment. You kind of got to, you know, don't blame your equipment. It didn't try to go to Mongolia with it. Wake up with bad intentions.
Again, this is the similar setup as Niger, but, you know, a little bit faster cadence and watching Bailey's beads go away, nice little prominence at the top.
Yeah, so this is my wholesome effort of 2008 with all that equipment and bashing up my gear and my Pentax 645. I had real film. Fred had cheater. You had digital. So now it's getting harder to process my film and harder to scan the film. And once I've scanned the film, then it's not aligned as easily as it is in the digital. So my spirits are just starting to get dejected that he's over here. And his work product is going up and up and up, and mine is really stagnated, and it's not really going anywhere.
That's mine.
Yeah, right?
And I got stars for the first time. That was like, oh, cool. I've always wanted to see stars.
Oh, did we need to go back? Over here?
Yeah,
so those are when you have this used to be one of the only ways you could see prominences on the sun before the filters that we have were invented. This is going on all the time. And if you just cover up the sun, what you have left are the prominences in that outer area around. So if he's protruding out beyond how much larger the moon is than the photosphere, that's when you see the prominences out on the edge. So almost all eclipses show prominences, unless they're very, very shallow.
Another Bailey's bead sequence.
Brat. All right, so this one we either had China with the weather was and then Kiribati, Kira Boss. I don't know how they got that out of it. How many people have been to Kira Boss? So actually, this little diddly-doddly island country is actually as broad as the United States. It's mostly water. And this is the local transport, so trying to organize something in advance wasn't that great. We hired the biggest boat in the country. And we went from Tarawa to a little island named Maracay. We thought we might, there's another Tari, we thought about, but as we started to look at the ship and realized that the locals just sleep in a pile in the cargo hold, I thought that might not be fun.
Maybe didn't want to spend a lot of time on that ship.
Well, the other problem was that the boat is capable of 12 knots, but the driver's figured out fuel efficiency because he can't get fuel, and he drives at three knots. You can swim faster. So we start taking out to the island of Maracay, and this is where we discovered you can see an island on the horizon if it's there, because the blue or green lagoon will shine that color reflected back on the underside of a cloud base, and you can tell, follow where the green clouds are, that's where an island is.
We had another repeat of the Galapagos where we had to punch through the storm to the other side.
Oh, this was awful. And, you know, the ship is only going to go 4 knots, and you're cruising along, and a big storm comes up. The lid was flying off the top because they put a tarp over it. They're literally holding the top on the boat down. And the locals, they don't seem to mind. And we get out to this itty-bitty little island, Maracay, that heard we were coming because once a week they get the fax machine cranked up. So we get out to the island.
They don't ever get tourists there.
The last time they had tourists there was World War II. So we're a big deal. We're a big deal. And so the whole town comes out, and the mayor greets us on the edge of the island, and it's really, they've got this superstition that you have to go around the island or they'll kill and eat you or something. I don't really know. So we get on to the island, and we start passing out the solar viewers, and the mob comes out, absolute mob. Every person has come from nearby islands. I don't know, maybe they swam. And this fellow, he's going to do an article about eclipse chasers in a magazine, and so he wants to see just how nutty we are, which apparently he had trouble choosing which nutty professor of us he was going to do the article about. But it doesn't take very long before we realize these clouds caught up with us, and now they're coming our way, and it's looking really grim. So we had to get back on the better boat. For some reason, every boat in this country had the words better boat. Somebody has to be the not better boat in order to have a better boat. I don't think they understand the term. So we get back onto our ship, and this is the biggest ship in the country. The Minister of Tourism and his wife was with us. The head of the head of the weather office was with us, and we take out on the boat, and guy comes running up, well, where do you want me to steer to?
The clouds are moving really fast. They're rolling through and changing.
We don't know the weather pattern. Now we're lost because he doesn't have his satellite weather with him. We're out in the middle of, you saw this country, there's no way to get data. So I looked at the weather guy and I go, hey, why don't you go steer the ship? So we sent the head of the weather department up to pick a spot. So at least then we could concentrate on our equipment. So now we have to set up the gear. There's Fred, he's got his great gear, and there's our case. All mine got there, here's my daughter Libby. We later had this published in the magazine and realized this is our family photo. I'm taking the photo. There's Fred, there's my daughter, and Shadow says, where's me? There you are, honey. So this is our equipment. There's my hopes, there's my dreams. You cannot use a tracking man on a moving boat. So I get out onto the boat, look down at my pile of gear, and I don't know what direction we're going to be pointing. This is a last minute chase. I am completely stiffed on equipment. Fred, on the other hand, is perfectly happy.
I've done this in the Galapagos. It's like, okay, let's call up this. We're going to do this.
So there are a few terse words after this eclipse about maybe working together, whatever. I don't know. Oh, look, there's a better boat. So he got back to the work of doing his eclipse photography. And you notice nobody else has anything to do because they can't really set up their tripods either, so Fred is the big spectacle. We did have a lot of clouds. We broke clear just in time. this was the whole sum photographic effort of the expedition. That was as good as it got. But
we all saw it.
China had it worse. Yep. And then we went back to the island. And what I really have to say, this island really demonstrated that, you know, these people, they haven't seen white guys since 1943. So, you know, we were the most amazing spectacle they could ever see. They prepared for us this enormous, they heard we were coming, they put everybody together. They did this was called the airplane dance, and it's only done once a year to commemorate when the airplanes came in World War II. Very passionate about this. The entire island town got together. It was moving. And I started to realize, you know, all of this gunk, we left them sitting on this island. They got skunked and clouded out on their island. So the people are starting to play a different role, especially with my efforts in the photography. 2010, there's Mike here. There's Fred's here. Fred has now taken over the AT-111 that I use in Mongolia. We use two little Ioptron mounts. I don't even know, is this in the spectrohelioscope, Oscar? I think that's that little red scope. This is a Fred camera, that's a Fred camera, here's my Pentax. I haven't yet processed the film.
What? What's the point?
What's the point?
That's Mike.
Wow.
What's the point? We do want to point out that there was a fellow on Tatakoto Island out in Tahiti that during the partial phases was asking Fred if he had a copy of the SDK firmware.
The driver for the Canon camera.
So he's on the island in the Pacific asking for drivers for his laptop. And the sad thing is we had them.
We were a little bit off center line, so it's not, you know, straight across, but
these are the nice same prominences that you see in your H alpha scopes outside. They have to stick out pretty well. So, I mean, with a high power telescope, this would be enormous. Randy would have all kinds of a heyday with that. But you have to back it out for a wider field for totality. Australia 2002, we're starting to notice that every eclipse trip we're going on, my poor little shadow is just throwing up the whole trip. So she's got an inner ear thing. It's going to have to be our last travel. So the old trusted C5 came out again. There is no Pentax. And I just figured I'd fiddle around with H-alpha and just view the partial phases. Because at this point, why bother?
We had a really big time with clouds and trying to find a spot where there wouldn't be clouds. And in the end, there was one unlucky cloud that was there at totality.
It looked great, so,
If we're going to be okay,
So we got in a little bit too heavy into our, invested into our location, so moving just really wasn't a possibility. Plus, you know, it came in really quickly. There was, and this, you want to talk about the silver lining in the cloud.
You can see
these
the shadow.
These are shadow bands from the eclipse onto the clouds. So while our skunk, the thing that you're expecting isn't what you get, and the thing that you get isn't what you were expecting. So here's our recommendations. The best equipment is the gear that you already know already. So here's an exercise. Take the equipment you plan on bringing, bring your wife out to the backyard with you, and have her yell at you for about 45 minutes while you move it around. This is what eclipse photography is going to be like, because somebody's going to be arguing with you, and you're going to be moving it around the location. Never, ever, ever wait until you're on the flight to read the instructions. Never, ever, 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 ever. Be prepared to improvise. Fred, you always say practice, practice, practice. You'll run those routines, what, 6-8 times?
800.
Yeah. He actually had to, the Eclipse orchestrator, he actually had to stop selling the software in the last week because they buy it.
We would get too many people who would buy it on the flight over where they're going, then they don't have time to rehearse and they want to blame me for their failure.
Right.
We have to be prepared. Again, how many of those stories that I told required us to hop and go, or that we didn't hop and go and then we were skunked? There's absolutely nothing, well, 4 minutes of clouds is not worth 2 seconds of totality. I don't care how short your duration is, where you're going to go for your sucker hole, get to the sucker hole. and keep alert. So if you're fussing and worrying all about your equipment and all of the things that you're going to get ready, you get these plans in your head. You're going to be doing walks around the block every night planning. And then we're going to bring the C5. You know, that C5 works really great. We should upgrade. You know, I can do this on it. I heard that you'll be making these enormous and elaborate plans, right, Matt? And then on eclipse morning, you're so involved in your plans that you just took the weather for granted. And the less complicated plan you have, the easier. Think about my boat in Maracay, where it's just sitting in a pile. So if you keep it simple, stupid, it's less likely to fail. And don't forget that the moment, the eclipse chasers, the local people that you're going to meet. Yes, this is an American eclipse, but the guys that you go and hang out with and have a party, the lady who lets you view on her land, the people who all got together, that's your experience as well as this celestial event. And like, you know, we're going to tell you don't bother, but you're going to be on your knees sobbing, I'm sorry. And it's going to be the best fun of your life.
That's good.